The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Okay. All right, great to see you. What we've been doing this is now week six, is working our way through Matthew's Gospel. And we've come to the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus up onto the mountain, speaks to the crowds, disciples at the front, crowd at the back listening. This is our third week of the Sermon on the Mount. Now what I've got, I've got 15 minutes, I'm going to take a couple of minutes to get you up to speed with what we looked at last week, because this is part two of, part two, the idea of it's the heart that matters. Okay, all right, here we go. Did you know that in 1936 there were only 88 pages of Australian taxation law? Right? I ought to be a tax agent in those days. In 2008, when Ken Henry did his tax review, there was 5,743 pages of tax law. An accountant told me this morning, that's just the law, then there's thousands of other pages of decisions about it and rulings, and it never ends. Now the good news is, with all that taxation law, everyone in Australia pays all the tax that they should, right? Yeah, okay, you know, I'm dreaming. Isn't it interesting? You have so many laws, and still people don't pay the tax that they should. No one here, but other people, I mean. All right, that's one. Next one. I have three lovely daughters. Oldest one's married, youngest one's married, one in the middle isn't yet. Imagine, I'll give you the quick version, imagine her boyfriend turns up in a few months' time, a little sweaty in the palms, looking a little nervous, comes and says, Mr. Stewart, I need to talk to you. Yes. I want to ask for your daughter's hand in marriage. Can I have permission to marry her? He says, what's the minimum number of nights per week that I would need to spend with her to get your permission? Would you, if it was four, would that be, why am I at three? What if I spent three nights a week with her and one day on the weekend? Would that be enough? Two, maybe? And now, he's never going to do that, is he? To look for the minimum requirement of how much time he has to spend with the girl that he loves. Why? Because when you love somebody, you want to embrace it. You want to give everything you've got to it. The point of those two stories is very different approach to particular issues or commitments. That is, one is about avoiding things through trying to follow the detailed rules or look for loopholes. The other is actually embracing something that you love. So my point, if you embrace a cause with your heart, you don't need all the detailed rules. You just give yourself to it. If you really don't want to do it, what you'll do is look for all the minimums, the rules, that kind of thing, how you can avoid it. Now, hold that thought. As we look at the Sermon on the Mount, last week we saw that Jesus talks about entering the kingdom of heaven. So the end of chapter 5, verse 20. By the kingdom of heaven, I think he means, how do you know God through his king? How do you know God through Jesus? What does it mean to follow Jesus, to live in his kingdom, to be one of his people? Today we might say, to be a genuine Christian. And he seems to say something impossible. Now, it's on the screen, or it's in your handout. If you open it up, inside, you'll see Matthew chapter 5, verse 20, where Jesus says, for I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. So unless you do better than the Pharisees, the teachers of the law, when he says the law, he means the Old Testament. So in his time, you do a better job than the Pharisees and teachers of the law, be more righteous, well, you can't be one of his people. You can't belong to him. Now, that is like saying, unless you can run 100 metres faster than Usain Bolt, you can't get into heaven. And I say, why? The Pharisees and teachers of the law were fanatics about the Old Testament. They were the rules guys. They'd worked out, there were 613 laws in the Old Testament. 248 commandments, 365 prohibitions, 613 laws. If you're interested, if your mind happens to work this way, if you just Google 613 laws, there's a Wikipedia article that'll come up and explain how it all is put together. So how do you do better than that? Well, City Bible Forum's come up with a website that has 620 new laws to obey. And so you can... No, I'm joking. Thanks, John. That's a smile. Interesting. I was talking to a bunch of kids the other day, uni students, and I said there's 620 laws, and they all went, I'm joking. What's Jesus on about? The problem for the Pharisees and the teachers of law is this. They thought of God like the Australian tax office. How do you actually, keep the rules, but how do you do the minimum to avoid things rather than embracing God and loving him because he's good and wise? Therefore, taxation law rather than my sweetheart, right? Who do I love? I'll give you an example. So Matthew chapter 23 is part of Jesus' huge condemnation of their hypocrisy. He says this: "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill and cumin." So they, Old Testament 10%, they went out to their mint plants and they picked every tenth leaf and took that to the temple. It says, "But you've neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, faithfulness. You should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former. You blind guides, you strain out a gnat but swallow a camel." How do you love your neighbour when you've neglected justice, mercy and faithfulness? There's other ones where he says, they love flowing robes and they pray on street corners and then they kick a widow out of a home because she's missed a mortgage payment. So that's the problem. Now, the good news is what God promised in the Old Testament in a number of places, but here's the prophecy of Ezekiel. Ezekiel's a prophet about 600 BC. Look at what God promised. He said, and this is speaking to his people, to Israel. The good news is God promises he'll do this to anyone who'll come to him. "I'll give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I'll remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. I'll put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws." If you actually... pretty tough call today on a whole lot of things, but don't walk away depressed. If you find yourself actually wanting to obey God, if you find yourself actually wanting to trust Jesus in this and live his way, and you get it wrong and you fall over and you mess it up, but if you actually want to, that is the miracle of the Spirit of God at work in your heart. The fact that you want to is a miracle. It's God's at work. Writing the law in our hearts, meaning that you want to obey him. Okay, there we go. There's a whole of last week's talk in about 4 minutes. You're wondering why did it take him 20 minutes to say it last week. What Jesus then goes on to do is to give examples of, six examples. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law, the minimum requirement. How do you kind of treat God like the tax act? What's the minimum that you can do? And then he talks about what it would look like if you actually embraced from the heart the way God wants you to live. And the six examples are anger and murder, adultery and lust, divorce, honesty, revenge and love for enemies. We looked at anger last week. In 15 minutes I thought I won't try and deal with adultery and particularly divorce. It's complicated, it's personal. There's lots more about this in the rest of the New Testament. So I thought we'd just deal with honesty, revenge and love for enemies today. Believe me, there's plenty to worry about in there. So on your sheet inside, if you open it up, I've skipped down a few verses and gone to verse 33, where Jesus talks about honesty and believing people. All right. Now, in 2016, news.com did a survey of Australia's most and least trusted professions. So, see, we naturally learn to be distrustful of people and people tell us lies. Who are the group that we trust the most? Well, first lot, nurses, pharmacists and doctors. So if you're in the medical profession, they're people who we expect will tell us the truth. And then you've got engineers, school teachers, dentists, police, high court judges, right down to if you're an accountant, you've done okay, and public servants. Now, who do you think came next? Who do you think came first? Lawyers or clergy? Lawyers or clergy? Well, you reckon, Todd, you're a lawyer. It was funny because lawyers and clergy are exactly the same. Right, exactly the same. And depending on whether you're a clergyman or a lawyer, you think, oh, that's a bit rough. Anyway, so, yeah. Now, when you look at the rest, public opinion pollsters, well, I guess if they don't tell us the truth, none of this is worth anything. And then politicians took a bit of a beating at 23, 24, right down to used car, to car sales. We expect that people will lie to us, or we're concerned that they will. So what do we do? Well, we've introduced a series of things where, for example, you take an oath. You swear on the Bible, and if someone swears on the Bible, you know they're telling the truth, right? Obviously, and they'll do as they promise. Now, it's all covered by the Oaths Act, New South Wales 1900. There's big penalties if you commit perjury, lie under oath, etc. The problem was, or if I could say, the minimum requirement. See what these people, look at verse 33. Jesus says, "Again, you've heard that it was said to people long ago, do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you've made." Now, he's quoting what their teachers have said. So, if you like, the minimum requirement they're saying is, well, if you just say something, well, you don't have to worry about that, but if you take a specific oath before God, you've got to keep your word on that. The problem was, they even played, I don't know if you've heard the expression, bush lawyers on that. So the idea of bush lawyers is someone who wants to pull words apart and try and weasel out from what they've said, try and argue about detail. Look at what Jesus says. This is one of many examples that he gives. So the Pharisees would say, "Woe to you blind guides. You say, if anyone swears by the temple, it means nothing. But anyone who swears by the gold of the temple is bound by that oath. You blind fools, which is greater, the gold or the temple that makes the gold sacred?" So they're saying, "Oh, now look, I know I took an oath, but I only swore by the temple. I'm not really bound. If I'd sworn by the gold of the temple..." Now that one, so it's like saying, "Sure, I said that, but I had my fingers crossed behind my back." Look what Jesus says is the if you actually embrace things with your heart, what does he say? See verse 34. "But I tell you, do not swear an oath at all, either by heaven, for it's God's throne, or by the earth, for it's his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it's the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. All you need to say is simply yes or no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one." And you see, what's Jesus' alternative to swearing oaths and saying, "Oh, on my mother's grave, or on my child's head, or I..." Jesus' alternative, verse 37, tell the truth. Be a person of truth. You say yes, it means yes. You say no, it means no. And you keep your word. Okay, not too hard. Look at the next one, verse 38, about revenge. He said, "You've heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth." Yes. That is a quote from the Old Testament. Where that comes up, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, it's known as the Lex Talionis. Wikipedia's got a pretty good article on it. Here we go. The principle is sometimes referred to by the Latin term Lex Talionis, or the law of the talon. The English word talion, from the Latin talio, means retaliation, authorised by law, in which the punishment corresponds in kind and degree to the injury. So eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Now, the Old Testament does say that. So there's in the book of Leviticus, it's one of the books of Moses that set up the laws for ancient Israel. Anyone who injures their neighbour is to be injured in the same manner, fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. The one who has inflicted the injury must suffer the same injury. So what's Jesus saying? It's like when it comes to taking revenge, the minimum requirement, the minimum law is this. Well, I'll just take revenge up to a certain point, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, and no more. Now, you notice this law is actually given to stop the inevitable feuding and escalation of things. You know, like you poke me in the eye once, I poke you in the eye twice. You poke me in both eyes and cut off an ear, then I come and poke your brother in both eyes, and it goes on and on. And notice also, it's a third party. It's the idea of the judiciary or someone in charge imposing this. He doesn't say, get your own revenge. It's to actually limit revenge. Now, what does Jesus say? Well, Jesus goes on to say something I think that's pretty tough. He says, don't take revenge at all. In fact, sit lightly to your rights. See verse 39? He says, "But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If someone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also." You notice what he says. And look, these are very hard things. I know I rushed through it, but this is a very tough thing to live out in, you know, friendly corporate Australia. When he says, when someone strikes you on the cheek, he doesn't say, if someone punches the lights out, get up again and let him do it again. It's literally talking about a slap on the face, all right, or a slap in the face. And also, someone pointed out, the Bible tends to assume that people are right-handed. Not always, it tends to. So if someone strikes you on the right cheek, right hand, right cheek is by definition a backhander. And we still say it's kind of like a backhander. So it's the idea of a slap in the face. And what Jesus is saying is you get a slap in the face, maybe literally, but probably metaphorically, the idea of your honour's a bit damaged, you feel a little offended, don't retaliate. Don't retaliate. Or he keeps going, verse 40. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. I think he's saying, just like sit lightly to your rights. Verse 41, if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. The scholars tell me that a Roman soldier at that time in Israel could literally grab a Jewish civilian and make him or her carry his pack 1,000 steps. The word million mile meant literally 1,000 steps. And Jesus is saying, look, they do that to you, you have to carry it 1,000 steps, carry it 2,000. Carry it the extra. And that's where the phrase the extra mile comes from. Go the extra mile. And the last one, give to the one who asks you and don't turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. What's he saying? I know you can immediately think of a whole lot of hypothetical situations where this would be difficult and what about this or what about that. But how about we just let's at least embrace what he's saying, big picture. He's saying this. Sit lightly to our rights rather than have to have revenge. And he gives 4 examples. Sit lightly in terms of being insulted or having our honour damaged. Sit lightly to our possessions, our inconvenience and labour, our time and our money. This is if you'd follow him. And why, if you follow him, can you do this? He's in charge. He's got it. He can care for us if we're his people. It means that we can be generous. We can sit lightly to our rights. Now, before you think that's difficult, have a look at the last one. Love your enemies. See verse 43? This is just wild. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbour and hate your enemy. Now, often when Jesus says you've heard that it was said, he's not quite quoting the Old Testament so much as what the teachers, the religious teachers of the time had made up. So he doesn't say it was written. When he quotes the Old Testament directly, he says it is written. He's saying you've heard that it was said. Well, let's have a look. See, the Old Testament said, do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against anyone among your people, but love your neighbour as yourself. I am the Lord. Now, where's the bit about love your neighbour? Where's the hate your enemy bit? It's not there. So they've made up, sure, love your neighbour and hate your enemy. That's the minimal position. Got it? So God says love your neighbour. Yeah, I will, sure. And I'll hate my enemy. Jesus says, if you actually will embrace what it is that he wants, embrace what God says about how to treat people, have a look at what he says in verse 44. He says, but I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. I'll read it again. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. And what does it mean to love your enemies? Well, I put it to you, it's not the same as giving them everything you want. Sorry, everything they want. And love your enemies. It's not the same as giving into them on everything they want. It's not the same as being walked on. It's not the same as being a doormat. It doesn't come from a position of weakness. It actually may mean standing up to them. It may mean stopping them doing certain things. But I think what he means is to act in their best interests, to do what is best for them and kind for them. There's a number of different words in the Greek language. This is exactly the same word for love as when it talks about God loves his people, Jesus loved the people that he died for, you know, God so loved the world. That's it. Love your enemies in this way. Do what's best for them. Show them kindness. If you're taking notes or thinking later, the Apostle Paul picks this up in Romans chapter 12, where he talks about how to treat those who are against you and treat you badly, how to respond. He says, love them. Do what's best for them. Why? Now, Jesus gives us 2 reasons. See verse 45. First reason to do this that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes the sun to shine on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. Meaning, God's kind to his enemies as well. So you've got two farmers, one that honours God and follows him, one that totally ignores God. They both get the rain. They both get the sun. God is generous even to those who aren't his people and aren't obedient to him. Right? So the first one is to be like God. The second reason, verse 46, if you love those who love you, what reward have you? What reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? You love people who are like you and who are your friends. Big deal. Right? So you love your family or you love your neighbours or you love people like you. Everyone does that. It's when you love those who are against you, when you love those who are your enemies, that's when it really shows trust in God. And then he finishes, and I know we'll leave time for questions and comments. When he finishes, he says, be perfect, therefore, as your Father in heaven is perfect. It's a massive claim on his followers to be perfect the way God is perfect. Now, let me confess, I'm not exactly sure what he means. It's a command, and he's certainly setting the bar incredibly, almost impossibly high. But you see, that word for perfect in the original language is teleos, okay? Perfect. And it can have a number of different meanings. It can mean being an adult human being, being mature or growing up. It can mean what's fully accomplished or finished. It can mean having no defect, meaning just like our word perfect. Or it can mean lacking no moral quality, being morally perfect. So it's a little hard to know. Does he mean that be a growing up the way that God's a growing up, in the way that you treat everyone with love? Or does he mean be morally perfect the way that God is morally perfect? If it's the first one, probably just relating to love your enemies. If it's morally perfect, it's probably talking about all of chapter 5. Either way, I think he's setting the bar so high. There's a couple of responses. One is to say it pushes us to know our need for forgiveness, that we can't live this way. It should make us humble in the way that we treat other people. This is a massive call. We're not all followers of Jesus, I know. If you are a follower of Jesus, it's a massive call to try and live this way, to treat people this way, especially in the rough and tumble out there in the real world. Why can you do it? It's because once you believe that actually Jesus is in control, that he is the one who will care for us, that he wants us to treat others this way, and he'll look after us, it means you can do this from a position of, if you like, strength and confidence, rather than weakness or kowtowing in front of people. But it's a huge call to act in trust and treat people this way.
You know, you grab a lawyer and try to get out?
Okay. Having never been like I have, Mike, you see, once God drops you into certain places and you begin to try and work out from the Bible, it becomes clear what you should do, but from a distance, I've got to say. A couple of things you see the Apostle Paul do. One is, there's a sense in which you cop it from the government. That God puts governments in place, and sometimes Christians have to cop it. The fact that being Christian and following Jesus will mean certain, you'll get bruises for doing that. But I think it's not wrong to defend yourself, and certainly not wrong to take every legal opportunity to defend yourself. Because you see Paul doing that. For example, in Acts chapter 16 in Philippians, when they lock him up illegally, and then they beat the living daylights out of him, and then the city rulers find out he's a Roman citizen, and they realise they've been in deep trouble for what they've done, and they say to him, just leave quietly. Now, he insists on his rights and a public apology. Why? Because he's about to leave. And he's about to leave a little baby church of very vulnerable Christians there, and I think he does it to look after the third party. Okay? But you do see Paul call on his own Roman citizenship to protect himself and to be of use whenever he gets the opportunity. So I don't think it's wrong to defend yourself legally. I don't think it's wrong to move away from persecution. You don't have to look for being persecuted. Jesus says you need to be public about being Christian. Don't be ashamed of him. But I don't think it's wrong to move. You don't have to go looking for persecution. Now that's a long answer. Do you want to push back? I think Paul and his citizenship's a good model. He doesn't run away from persecution, but he uses what's available to him to defend himself and particularly others. So I think, and it's actually so he does that.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.